I'm Dave Satcher, and I'm moderating this session. And the title of this session is Health Disparities and the Intersection of Science and Policy. I'm actually very pleased to be a part of this segment of the program. I want to join in congratulating Dr. Ruffin and his staff and all of those who are responsible for bringing all of us together on this great occasion. It's been a long time coming, as you've heard before, but we are here. It's a very important day and very important week, and we're delighted to be able to continue to move forward in dealing with the issues of health disparities in the United States. I somehow feel like I've spent a lot of my career at this intersection between science and policy, whether as an academic dean or president, or the years I spent as director of the CDC, or as Surgeon General and Assistant Secretary for Health. So I always felt that I had the responsibility of helping to generate and understand the science, but at the same time, the important responsibility of trying to influence policies in directions that were consistent with the science. There was a time when I thought that all you needed was the best available science to make things happen in this country to improve the health of people. But I learned that while it is critical to have the best available science, in order to influence policy, you have to deal with this great intersection that we're going to be talking about today. And we have some great speakers who have spent a lot of their careers working in this arena. I have to tell you a story. Those of you who know me know that I like to tell stories. And I first told this story on a morning when I think there were 15 inches of snow on the ground in Washington. It was in January of 2000. And we had brought together a group of about 2,000 people to release Healthy People 2010. And when we woke up that morning, I believe it was January 10th, 2000, we woke up to 15 inches of snow, and the government announced that the government was shutting down for that day. However, we had invited all of these people. They were in the hotel. Nobody expected that much snow. And so Donna Shalala and I decided that even though the government was shut down, we were going to move forward and release Healthy People 2010. I never checked the rules to find out if that was legal, but we did it. But as you know, there were only two goals of Healthy People 2010. One was the goal of improving not just the years of life that people live, but the quality of that life. And the second goal was the goal of eliminating disparities in health among different racial and ethnic groups in the country. On that occasion, I told a story that I had heard from Neil Lane when we had been traveling together in South Africa. But and I'm sure many of you have heard it, but it's worth repeating. The story is about a man who was traveling across the country in a hot air balloon and at a certain point realized that he was lost. He decided he would lower the balloon to see if he could recognize any landmarks. So he lowered the balloon. He didn't see anything that he could recognize, so he kept lowering it. And it was only after he got to about 30 feet above ground that he spotted a man working in the field below. And he yells out, "Where am I?" And the man stopped digging, and he looked up and said, "Well, you're in a hot air balloon about 30 feet above ground." Well, the man in the balloon said, "You must work in science. You sound like a scientist." And the man stopped working and he said, "My goodness, I am a scientist, but how in the world could you have known that?" And the man in the balloon said, "Well, I knew that because what you've told me is technically correct, but it is of absolutely no use to me right now." Well, not to be outdone, the man on the ground said, "Well, you sound like one of those policymakers from Washington or somewhere." And the man on the balloon said, "Wow, I'm a leading policymaker, but how could you have known that?" And the man on the ground said, "I knew that because you were in the same position you were when we met. You don't know where you are, you don't know where you're going, and now you're blaming me." Well, in this intersection between science and policy, It's always easy to blame, but the challenge is to make sure that we continue to advance policies in this country that are consistent with the science. That is not an easy task, and it's one worth the discussion we're going to have this morning with an outstanding panel. I want to begin by introducing the keynote speaker. Robert Valdez is well qualified to discuss this topic. He's worked in policy for many years. I had the opportunity to work with him both when I was director of the CDC and, well, even before that, because we were both on the Hillary Clinton's task force for health care reform, which didn't quite make it through. But I also worked with him when I was director of the CDC and then when I was Surgeon General. He now serves as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Professor of Family and Community Medicine and Economics at the University of New Mexico. He is also Executive Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center for Health Policy. In the interest of time, and since you have his bio in your books, let me just say that Bob Valdez has been involved in policy development and analysis and communication for many years. He is well qualified to introduce this very important topic of health disparities and the intersection of science and policy. Bob.
Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me to help get this National Summit on Health Disparities research started. Thanks especially to Dr. Rainyard Kingdon and to Dr. John Ruffin for their leadership, and to the rest of the NIH staff who've worked so diligently and hard to put this summit together. And a special thanks to Dr. Angelou for her really inspiring presentation. Hearing her time and time again, I'm always amazed at how something fresh and new always comes flowing from her lips. It's an honor to be with Dr. Satcher, who, as Surgeon General and head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, really provided the leadership that challenged us to address health disparities in every town, reservation, and urban center of our nation. But most of all, thanks to all of you who've taken up this scientific, and yes, for many of us, a personal quest to eliminate health disparities in our society through scientific discovery. Scientific discovery that will improve clinical practice, community interventions, and yes, equity in our society. I'm going to talk about three things this morning. I want to make some comments about the importance of interdisciplinary science, that is, bringing biomedical scientists and social scientists together to really address the complex issues that are before us. I'd like to make some comments about some of the conceptual challenges that, as scientists, we must overcome if we're, in fact, going to eliminate health disparities. And lastly, to make some comments about this intersection of policy and science. Interdisciplinary research plays an increasingly important role in addressing highly complex social issues, such as health disparities. It allows scholars to reach beyond the boundaries of their disciplines and to adapt or develop new methods of analysis. For example, how might we think about the leverage points for interventions to reduce or eliminate health disparities in our society? I use this little graphic that was developed by the Prevention Institute as a way of trying to bring social scientists and medical scientists and biomedical scientists together. The graphic shows us one way of thinking about addressing this complex issue. It raises legitimate research questions for interdisciplinary teams of health and social scientists at every juncture. Because individuals are born into our society or move into our society, a society that neither treats people nor distributes treats people equally nor distributes opportunity equally. The little root factors, that little moon in the middle of the environment box. Discrimination, poverty, and other forms of oppression play out at the community level, affecting our overall community environment in which people work for pay, play, and pray. Especially in resource-poor communities, the stresses of daily life bear down on our minds and bodies, inviting illness and disease. Through environmental exposures and other types of stress, such as limited access to the basic necessities of life, including healthcare services. These environmental factors, in turn, shape our behaviors, such as eating and activity patterns. What's available becomes part of our decision-making. What's not available cannot even be considered. So when we recommend that people eat more fruits and vegetables to prevent disease, are they readily accessible? Are they a decent price? In many communities, the answer to these questions is clearly no. Similarly, our competitive model of healthcare delivery assumes that people can travel outside their neighborhoods to seek, as people say, the best medical care available, if you can afford it. But many in our country face major transportation limitations to these services, which are truly amazing and astounding, and many cannot afford them. This combination of the social, economic, and physical environment and behavioral factors contributes to an increased level of sickness and injury that requires medical services. Some have access to these medical services on a timely basis in a society in which medical services are a commodity, rationed on the basis of price. Inequalities in access to medical services and poor quality of medical services, especially in many Latino and indigenous peoples' homes throughout the country, are well documented and contribute to severe health disparities that are annually reported in our nation's health disparities report issued by the Agency for Health Research and Quality. While Congress has required documenting these disparities in health and health care, it has done little to remedy the situation. Over the last few years, private philanthropies such as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the California Endowment have recognized the need to address the root causes of these disparities, to focus upstream, as many people say, to prevent disparities by addressing the inherent inequities in our society, as well as addressing health care disparities, to create a more equitable society and thus a more healthy nation. Last year, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation launched a commission to look beyond the medical care system to improve the health of all Americans. All the evidence tells us that whether or not a person gets sick in the first place often has little to do with their health care. And yet a far greater determinant of a person's health is the relationship between how we live our lives and the surrounding economic, social, political, and physical environment. These efforts, however, require scientific evidence, evidence that only NIH-supported research can provide our society. The NIH, through its new initiatives, particularly translation from bench to bedside, and in its roadmap, its focus on behavioral change, can contribute significantly to building the knowledge base necessary to devise interventions, programs, or policies to accomplish the goal of eliminating health disparities and thus creating a healthier republic. My colleagues at the Prevention Institute's recent comprehensive review of the scientific literature suggests targets for our research and policy analysis efforts. Each of these areas are clear opportunities for interdisciplinary research with practical implications for policy intervention. The three areas for research for improving every community's health are equitable opportunity, which really refers to the level and equitable distribution of opportunity and resources. Place, because yes, place matters. It refers to the physical environment in which people live, work, play, and pray. Decisions about place, including such things as look, feel, safety, truly influence many behaviors. And people, the most important of all in any society, refers to the relationships between people, the level of social engagement and social norms. We know that strong social networks and connections correspond with significant increases in physical and mental health. Changing social norms has been the basis for our successes in reducing smoking in our society. Now, I encourage you to think about how you, in collaboration with others in this room and others who are not here today, can work with you to create a healthy America by creating more just and equitable communities through the insights of interdisciplinary science. Interdisciplinary research, collaborations among health and social scientists, funded by the NIH over the last decade, have increased our understanding that mind and body are not separable domains. In fact, neither is independent of the other. I recommend to you the book edited by my colleague at the University of New Mexico, Frank Kessel, and Patricia Rosenfeld and Norman Anderson, entitled Interdisciplinary Research, Case Studies from Health and Social Science. This book illustrates important cutting-edge interdisciplinary research. It illustrates how teams have created new methods for combining social and biological measures, new ways to combine data from brain imagery and genetic analysis with social and behavioral analysis. New insights from these interdisciplinary studies provided the knowledge base for recent state policy advances, such as Arizona's Proposition 203, which passed in the last election by an overwhelming majority, called First Things First, the Arizona Early Childhood Development and Health Board. This proposition is intended to build a system for early childhood development that gives all Arizona children, birth to five, the opportunities to achieve their maximum potential to succeed in school and life. It was the use of brain imagery, that new technology, the ability to demonstrate to legislators what happens to children in the course of development in different kinds of environments, in deprived environments, in environments where kids have opportunity. That evidence, that biological evidence, drove the agenda, the political agenda. Policies that support the development of interdisciplinary fields that integrate the social and biological sciences could represent the 21st century breakthrough, similar to that breakthrough we experienced in the 20th century that developed the fields of molecular biology and molecular genetics. Supporting the institutional leadership training and curriculum development that's required, however, will require NIH, our own universities, and the academy as a whole to be more institutionally flexible and innovative. Risk-taking is not the hallmark of most of these institutions. However, there are efforts to stimulate, undertake, and systematically study transdisciplinary science, as illustrated by the NCI's recent conference, and its recent published supplement in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. Research priorities are policy that both Congress and the leadership of NIH play large roles in defining and supporting, as you've already heard. Yet a group of chronic and highly debilitating diseases disproportionately affect the poor have largely been ignored by the NIH and other agencies. Poor Americans, whether you're speaking about African Americans, American Indians, Latinos, Asian Americans, or others, those living in the Mississippi Delta that you heard about earlier this morning, or in high poverty neighborhoods in urban centers, or in the U.S.-Mexican borderlands. These people are affected by these diseases that receive relatively little scientific attention and form a base for increased vulnerability to all the other diseases and illnesses that we commonly focus on. Poor Americans harbor chronic infections that contribute to health disparities we've documented. Furthermore, these chronic infections promote persistent poverty through their impacts on child development, pregnancy outcomes, and disabling physical effects. Yes, poor housing without plumbing, air conditioning, or windscreens promotes vector-borne diseases, which carry many of these types of infections. And this easily describes housing along the U.S.-Mexico border and on many American Indian reservations. Among the most vulnerable populations, farm workers, those who put food on our tables and are among the poorest of the poor, experience hazardous work conditions and exposure to infectious agents, and yes, these kinds of housing conditions I just described. And yet, these kinds of infections and conditions are rarely high on the American research agenda. Research and development of new control tools, including improved diagnostics and accelerated development of a vaccine to prevent congenital CMF infection and congenital toxoplasmosis, as well as policies that increase active surveillance, targeted treatments, and increased vector control are all needed to diminish health disparities significantly. There's an urgent need to define transmission dynamics, including molecular genotyping of the parasites, to design more effective interventions. We need better diagnostic tests that use standardized and purified recombinant antigens. In other cases, we need to better understand treatment regimens. Clearly, improvements in environmental sanitation and housing improvements would also greatly benefit residents of poor communities. And obviously, to many of us, but not well understood, housing policy and environmental policy is also health policy. Sequencing the human genome, a great scientific achievement, provided definitive proof for the lack of a biological basis for the concept of race. At the same time, our institutional and political structures reflect this social construct, and race and racism is real. We rely on social constructs to explain the world and to understand it. Scientists are not immune to using these constructs, however, in dangerous ways. When I arrived in New Mexico earlier this year, I had the opportunity to participate in the annual Cancer Center's retreat. There, researchers shared the marvelous molecular discoveries that have brought about a revolution in genomic research advances and offered their prospects for innovations in treatment for a wide variety of cancers. I was taken aback, however, when researchers began to explain their findings in ways that can all too easily be misinterpreted in policy and clinical circles. Resorting to explaining statistical propensities for groups of people in the state using common racial structures and stereotypes. In effect, the interpretations of these propensities denied American Indian spiritual beliefs, challenged the history of Hispanic settlement in the region, and posed findings in ways that can be misinterpreted in policy development. We've used the construct of race in legal efforts to eliminate racism in the distribution of opportunities to benefit from quality health care and education. In the areas of banking and housing, for example, we saw the elimination of public policies that restrict groups of people from living in certain neighborhoods. Some of the last of them being erased only in the 1970s. Yet, as the Genome Project demonstrated, race has no biological basis, but rather is a social construct. Our science, however, has become negligent in defining how or why we use these concepts and constructs in our research. We've accepted this social construct as if it were a static characteristic that allows us to adequately or appropriately compare the health of different groups in our society, or as a proxy for many unmeasured factors in our study that may be amenable to clinical intervention or social policy intervention. But racial or ethnic identities are fluid, both in government and social terms. This very term Hispanic, which is often used, in fact, which was created to combat discrimination, was created in 1976 by Congress as an official term to group together a population that differs enormously by history, nationality, social class, legal status, generation under U.S. authority. This term has really no meaning outside of the U.S. context. And now the country's largest minority group, truly behind the numbers, is a complex story of diversity along many dimensions that will shape my community's social and economic narrative for decades to come. I recommend the recent National Academy of Science book entitled Hispanics and the Future of America to you, because it challenges us to be more precise with our categories of analysis and interpretation. The subjective meaning of such labels and whether they're situationally asserted are open empirical questions. A colleague of mine responded recently to another in response to an examination of workforce diversity in a public health organization on which I serve as a board member. I'm not an African American. I'm Canadian. Now, the context truly shapes the meaning of identity assignments and assertions, and the present context of civil rights, affirmative action, and ethnic revivals is in sharp contrast with the way immigrants were treated during the early 20th century, in particular the hostility meted out to assertions of Mexican ancestry. Ted Williams, one of our legendary baseball players of all time, is not known as a Latino player, even though his mother was Mexican-American. In his biography, he wrote, quote, "If I had my mother's name, there's no doubt I would have run into problems in those days with the prejudice that people had," unquote. Also, this construct of acculturation, which has been used without much thought, I think, a concept that was put forward to think about culture as moving linearly from one identity to another, from me moving from being Mexican to being American, and all that comes with these ideas. They limit our understanding of an important dynamic. Our identities are multidimensional, and this concept often hides more important dimensions that are amenable to clinical and social policy intervention, allowing us to address health disparities and discrimination. I urge you to consider using measures of cultural adaptation when you're looking at ways of understanding this dynamic that offer a multidimensional approach to cultural identity. These are critical dimensions for us to understand if the NIH initiatives in translation from bench to bedside is to be successful in all of our communities. The equity debate is loud and nasty. President-elect Obama was pejoratively called a socialist for wanting less inequity. This debate calls into question the very role of government. Should it redistribute wealth or protect property rights, encourage social equality, or enforce private contracts? This is really the wrong debate. It should not be about equal rewards for all, but about equal chances for all. What is both encouraging and significant is that the notion of giving people equal opportunity early in life, as illustrated by the Arizona proposition that passed recently, seems to be embraced across the political spectrum. Now, we've never been able to systematically measure these concepts. We've lacked the methodological tools to monitor equity, making it impossible to design, implement, and evaluate public policies that aim to rectify our social inequities. Many of our countrymen feel the uneven playing field under their feet and maintain that personal sense that their future is predetermined by conditions they have no control over, such as their skin color, gender, birthplace, or family wealth. And our political leaders have proved unwilling to address growing inequities, or more recently, contributed to its growth, thus further fueling the health disparities that you have all documented and are addressing. Increasing the national investments in research on the illnesses and conditions that the poor disproportionately experience must be part of the equation. Growing evidence indicates that racism is a key factor in the health disparities we observe. Racism in the form of racial segregation contributes to the stress and other environmental exposures that contribute to increased burdens of illness in poor neighborhoods. Over the last decade, the concept of allostatic load has been proposed to better understand healthy aging. This concept from the MacArthur studies of successful aging can be very useful in guiding our own understanding of health disparities. Stress promotes adaptation, But a failed shutoff of mediators after stress leads over time to wear and tear on the body and the mind. Bruce McEwen argues that allostatic load leads to impaired immunity, atherosclerosis, obesity, bone demineralization, and atrophy of the nerve cells of the brain. Allostatic load is seen in major depressive illness and may be expressed in other chronic disorders. Understanding how we intervene to mitigate the effects of allostatic load opens another avenue to reducing health disparities. Further understanding the physiologic and behavioral coping responses to daily events requires our better understanding of the nervous system, the targets of mediators of these responses. What's encouraging is that interdisciplinary teams and work of people like Bert Singer and Carol Riff and Teresa Seaman has brought us to theoretical, empirical, and programmatic insights into these processes. But better understanding about how adapting to life's challenges, efforts to respond to and overcome social inequities, affects our physical and mental health must be at the forefront of our efforts to eliminate health disparities. Clearly, reducing life's daily challenges by increasing social and economic opportunities must go hand in hand. Despite our success over the years in documenting health disparities, we failed to capture the attention of the public and of policymakers. Our professional jargon, health or health care disparities, does not capture the attention of people like my mother or my grandmother. Why? Because they know and they have often accepted the inequities in our society as the norm. But why do we need to capture their attention? Because 1/3 of American Indians die before the age of 45. Because African Americans die on average 5 to 6 years or more, depending on which communities you look at, than non-Hispanic whites. Because Latinos live lives burdened with severe disability and chronic disease. Unfortunately, so little attention has been paid to the situation in Asian American communities that I can't even offer a suggestion. Because policymakers respond to the public's most vocal concerns, our messages about health disparities need to be understood in language that everyone can understand. To create a truly healthy republic requires us to address health disparities on many fronts, recognizing its root causes and social inequities that are amenable to change through intersectoral policy changes. Economic policy is health policy. Education policy is health policy. Housing policy is health policy. Transportation policy is about health policy. And make no bones about it, agricultural policy truly is health policy. NIH and its sister agencies, AHRQ, FDA, and CDC, and the other federal departments acting in concert can develop programs with broad population perspectives in an effort to reduce health disparities. The NIH Roadmaps Research Teams of the Future focuses on interdisciplinary research, especially research on behavioral change and the initiatives at translation of biomedical discoveries to improved medical practices hold great promise for reducing health disparities, particularly if focused on the issues affecting low-income communities and neighborhoods. The evidence base supporting effective ways to reduce health disparities is limited. Many issues we wish to learn about do not lend themselves to randomized experiments, but natural experiments can be just as beneficial in advancing, just as beneficial in the absence of randomized clinical trials. Natural experiments created by new public policies provide opportunities for strengthening the knowledge base for more informed policymaking, and yes, for policy refinements. The great success story over the last 30 years has been the reduction in smoking by Americans. California's tobacco control program illustrates the use of available scientific evidence concerning the harms of smoking that supported early public policies of tobacco control, but also provided the resources necessary to continue building the science base for even more aggressive tobacco control and treatment of smoking-related diseases. Public and private policies that determine how income and wealth are generated and distributed have a substantial effect on our health and the existence of health disparities. Economic policy through progressive tax policy and living wages and safe work environments can provide the financial security that promotes health. Education policies promoting early childhood development through college education supports increased equity and promotes health. Housing policies can enable people to live in shelter that protects and promotes their health. President-elect Obama's economic stimulus package, for example, can create meaningful jobs that invest in better community infrastructure that makes the poorest communities healthier places to live. For example, by investing in changing our food distribution so that fresh fruits and vegetables are readily available, using the science and the recommendations that you've worked so hard to develop. Improving environmental sanitation, providing increased lighting, providing all communities with clean piped water, and a host of other investments that create the environment that change the trajectory of health disparities. There really is no time to waste. The U.S. has developed over the last decade a degree of income and wealth inequality not seen in our nation since the 1920s. We know enough to act and to continue to build the science base necessary for even more aggressive and effective efforts to eliminate health disparities. And I look forward to working with you to achieve that goal.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Valdez, for that very outstanding presentation, introducing us to the intersection between science and policy. I was thinking as you were coming near the end, I served for the last almost 4 years, I guess, on WHO's Commission on Social Determinants of Health. And one of the major recommendations, of course, was that commission that was that we invest in changing the conditions in which people are born and grow and learn and age. But it's very interesting because the commission also recommended that we try to promote a global movement for health equity. So it's amazing how, on a global basis, the issue of health equity through targeting social conditions has risen sort of to the top of the agenda. We have an outstanding panel of persons to follow, Dr. Valdez. And again, you have the bios in your book, so I'm going to be very brief. I'm going to introduce all three of them. Each one of them has been given about 15 minutes, and if they want to shorten that to 10 minutes to contribute to our catching up, that's fine, but we're not going to take anything away from them. The first panelist will be Dr. Moon Chen. Dr. Chen is a professor of the Division of Hematology and Oncology, Department of Internal Medicine at the University of California Davis School of Medicine. I'm familiar with his work. I'm trying to remember. I think I was director of the CDC. When we first met, he brought a group to the CDC to talk about ways in which we could really focus more attention on the prevention of cancer. So I've been very impressed with the work that he's done over the years. The second panelist will be Dr. Jeffrey Henderson, who is president and CEO of the Black Hills Center for American Indian Health. Has quite a fascinating history and has, at a very early age, really done some outstanding work that you're going to hear about as head of the Black Hills Center for American Indian Health. So we look forward to that. And finally, Brian Smedley is vice president and director of the Health Policy Institute of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Many of you already know Brian because of his work with the Institute of Medicine and outstanding leadership in directing such studies as unequal treatment, confronting racial and ethnic disparities in health, but also the unequal burden of cancer and other very important reports that came out of the Institute of Medicine over the years. So why don't we begin with Dr. Moon Chin.
Thank you, Dr. Satcher, and we have to thank Dr. Satcher for being the Surgeon General who articulated that one of the goals for our country is to eliminate health disparities. So thank you again, Dr. Satcher. Also want to thank Dr. Ruffin and his staff for this vision of bringing us together to talk about and ultimately eliminate health disparities. This is a tremendous event. It is a tremendous privilege for me to be part of this panel, Bob and Brian, Jeff, and just to think, you know, I'm about this country. I'm a grandson of a Chinese peasant from southern China who my grandfather helped build this railroad, and I think that he didn't speak any English at this time, and just to have my dad born in a Chinese laundry in Columbus, Ohio, and then for me to have this privilege to talk about and to address the health disparities of racial ethnic minorities is really a privilege. And so my challenge that has been presented today is to talk about how to eliminate health disparities. And when I think about this challenge, I ask myself, has there ever been a situation, a historical event, in which any health disparity has ever been eliminated? And if so, can I use that as a case model of how to eliminate health disparities? And I come to the conclusion that there has been. And so my talk today is going to be about proposing that the eradication of smallpox be considered a model for the elimination of a health disparity, because when smallpox was eradicated from the face of the globe, there is no difference in terms of incidence, mortality, or morbidity between any group of people, and that, in my mind, is the elimination of a health disparity. To do so, I'd like to propose that there's some parallels between smallpox and hepatitis B-induced liver cancer, because I can see that as a parallel. And then finally, to draw from that, principles for the key factors in terms of eliminating health disparities. So first of all, this great event in December of 79 was when the World Health Organization announced that smallpox had been eradicated from the face of the globe. Now think of that. Has there ever been an instance where there has ever been a disease affecting human beings that has been eradicated from the face of the globe? And in so doing, let me suggest that that was done because of the intersection and the synergy among science, practice, and policy. And so my vision for this is the lunar vision, moon vision of the world. Not a loony vision, but is for a world in which there are no health disparities. And so in so doing, I'd like to then draw upon the parallels comparing smallpox with hepatitis B virus. Like smallpox, hepatitis B virus only occurs in human beings. That is great, because then there is no animal source of infection, there is no environmental factors, the only thing we have to do is work with human beings. Now that is a challenge in itself. Then etiology. Both are viral. Well, that's great hope, because according to the World Health Organization, after tobacco, hepatitis B virus is the second most important carcinogen in the world. And so we have the opportunity, because of science, that we have developed a vaccine first against smallpox, and now the hepatitis B virus is considered the first anti-cancer vaccine. So that gives us some parallels and some hopes for me. And just to think about this review of the chain of communicable disease transmission, reservoir. This is the place where the virus or the disease organism lives and survives, only in human beings. agent, the virus, and host, the susceptible individual. Now, if the principle behind this reducing this disparity is to break the chain at the weakest link. And so in terms of reservoir, if there were some way in which we could make sure that all cases are detected, treated, and those that have not yet been infected prevented through vaccination, we have the opportunity to eliminate this disparity. And just to kind of put this on a worldwide basis, if you look at the countries in red, that's where the hepatitis B virus occurs disproportionately. It occurs disproportionately in countries of color. And in the United States, you know, it can be seen that while you have heard about the good news about cancer rates being reduced in the great majority of cancer sites, liver cancer, number two, remains to be the second most fastest increase in cancers. And this cancer affects disproportionately people of color. First of all, Asian Pacific Islanders, Hispanics, African Americans, and every population of color disproportionately is affected by hepatitis B infections. So again, this is an opportunity. Not only do we see this parallel in terms of smallpox being a fatal disease, hepatitis B virus is as it relates to liver cancer, it's almost invariably fatal, and this is the cancer type that is leading the country, increasing about 17% over the last several years in terms of reasons why this particular cancer is leading our country. And again, this is a cancer that disproportionately affects human beings, and in particular people of color. In fact, hepatitis B virus, when it causes liver cancers, is almost 95% fatal. And so this is an urgent problem, and it's something that we have the ability to address, because if we look at the model that smallpox represents, the science was the fact that there was available treatment and a vaccine. Same situation with hepatitis B. Practice, surveillance and detection, various the fact that it as a policy issue was had the political will of the World Health Organization and global countries to initiate vaccination and very aggressive case finding, to the point where after a period of about 20 years, smallpox could be declared eradicated. We have the same opportunity now with hepatitis B. With the universal implementation of infant vaccination for hepatitis B, we are beginning to spare the next generation from this disease. And, if you're 15 to 18 years old, you probably got the vaccine as a kid. And so from this point on, we could say that this disease could be prevented in your generation. And it is now the task of working with adults to make sure that they are properly screened, and then if they have the disease to be treated, if they have not yet been getting the disease, to be vaccinated. So I see this intersection of bringing together science, practice, and policy to the field of hepatitis B. I certainly realize that hepatitis B virus and smallpox are not the same as many of the other health disparities, but I think the principles are the same. And as this chart illustrates, the science of this is that vaccination does result in the reduction of various kinds of hepatitis-related risks. I think the same thing can be demonstrated in other diseases. This is Dr. Satcher, a letter that I saved from Dr. Satcher that he wrote to me, and again, in his role as Surgeon General at the time, he emphasized the importance of vaccination. And so, again, it's something very simple. It illustrates, again, the intersection of science, practice, and policy as a way to do this. And very fortunately, when studies have been done, this has been shown to be not only cost-effective and cost-beneficial, but really saving lives. Well, kind of in summary, I'd like to say to bring together, what does it take to reduce a disparity? First of all, in terms of science,
we find a disease that is worth the effort. And I know that there's many health disparities we need to address, but I think that our science can document the effect and impact of the disease. We need to have the evidence base to prevent and control it, and this is where the role of NIH-funded research goes. Then, following by that, we need the professional endorsement, and one of the lessons that we learned from hepatitis B is the fact that when we get the various professional organizations to endorse it, this has led to legislation that requires vaccination for school entry. In the process, other health economists haven't been able to document economic feasibility, so it actually saves lives as well as save dollars. And then, in terms of the policy, it is universal implementation and also the legal backing and social acceptance. In reality, it is not consecutive work, but all aspects working together, science, practice, and policy, that brings about this particular disparity reduction. And I submit to you that's the day that we all should look forward to, and it would be a very bright future when these disparities are eliminated. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Next is Dr. Jeffrey Henderson. Very encouraging.
Hihaniwashite mitakuyepi. Jeff Henderson na wawokia imachiapolo. Good morning, my relatives. In my Lakota tongue, I introduced told you that my name was Jeff Henderson, is Jeff Henderson, and that my Lakota name, which as a member of the Lakota Nation we're encouraged to share with audiences like this, is Wawokia, which means the helper or one who helps. It's a pleasure to be with you today. It's very encouraging and inspiring to see so many here with us today and over the next few days, and I wish to congratulate the National Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities staff and leadership for the vision in bringing this summit together, for those who participated in the decision to even engage in the planning and conduct of this summit. It's to your credit. I also wish to acknowledge the very inspiring and aspirational message of Ms. Angelou this morning, which certainly carries across all cultures. As a member of the Lakota Nation, one of the three principal speaking components of the Great Sioux Nation, I wish to point out for all of us here today that when we discuss the intersection of science, policy, and practice, that perhaps the single greatest situation in which we have a long track record of work at this intersection is when we examine American Indians and Alaska Natives here in this country. One of the reasons that I'm caused to think that way is because, in a very real sense, the term American Indian and Alaska Native is not a racial term, nor is it an ethnic term. It's a political term. The Office of Management and Budget, when on our census we're asked to describe ourselves as American Indian or Alaska Native, that is in recognition that is a political facet of the existence of our people. Why? That is because over 270 treaties were signed between American Indian and Alaska Native tribes and this federal government from the time of the first treaties in the late 18th century all the way through to 1878, when treaty making with Native tribes was finally stopped. And with those treaties, our Native people gave up most of the continent, most of the landmass, of what we know to be the United States. And in exchange for that, they reserved for themselves several things. In most of those treaties, they reserved for themselves land. And in fact, the formal term in a legal sense is reserved lands, which lends itself to the term that we use today, reservations. And the other thing that tribes typically did, not all, but most of them did, was they held unto themselves reserved property rights. Those property rights often fell in the realm of continued hunting and fishing rights and water use rights that they enjoyed in their original tracts of land that they then turned over to the federal government. That is why today American Indians and Alaska Natives might enjoy the opportunity to hunt and fish in their local area without respect to a formal hunting and fishing season that their state may have. It's also why on reservations, not all, but our people might be able to both hunt and fish without the purchase of a permit or a license from the state. And very, very often, this and other types of situations which reflect the acknowledgement of reserved property rights of tribes feeds into prominent stereotypes that we continue to encounter and try to address here even today. Coming back from the airport last evening, my wife and I were traveling in a taxi, and we came to find out that our driver was from Ethiopia, had been here in the United States for 12 years. Imagine the roll to my eyes when, after finding out that both my wife and I are tribal members, the first question out of our immigrant taxi driver's mouths were, "Do all you people live in mansions?" Astounding, just astounding. But you know what's even more concerning is that I most often hear those kind of comments from U.S. citizens born and raised all their lives here in the United States, and in particular, those citizens born and raised and living all their lives right around our people, right around the reservations. Most of you probably don't need me to share with you my thought that there has been an utter failure in our educational system to properly teach U.S. history and law. The U.S. Constitution acknowledges tribes, the existence of tribes, and the existence of tribal sovereignty. And the U.S. Constitution protects tribal sovereignty, as do the treaties that I mentioned that have been signed, subsequent case law, as well as basic human rights principles. There's a tremendous amount of lack of knowledge about what tribal sovereignty is, though, and I raise this in this context specifically to be speaking about the intersection of science and policy in efforts to address health disparities that it may exist in the American Indian or Alaska Native population. Sovereignty, simply stated, is self-rule. When a given entity can make the decision as to what the speed limit is going to be set within its lands, when it can decide on whether alcohol is going to be allowed in its midst, how it decides whether to tax tobacco products, how it decides what type of tort law or case law is going to be applied to those who should break laws, how it decides what the law is in the first place, and who it is that decides who is going to decide what the answers to those questions are. When you or that entity that's under consideration is able to say, "We do," that is sovereignty. When, however, your answers to those questions and other questions like this is, they do, or someone other than ourselves, that is not sovereignty. That entity is not a sovereign entity. In the 560 plus, I believe it is 562 right now, although that could be wrong, the 560 some odd federally recognized tribes in the United States each have tribal sovereignty. The difficulty occurs, though, is because there's a real tension between states' rights and the rights of other sovereign entities within the state, which in states that have Indian reservations primarily means those reservations or those tribal communities or Alaska Native villages. And over time, it's been a very uneven display of that sovereignty and use of that sovereignty by tribes, I'll be the first to admit. However, since the 1960s, when the Nixon administration was the very first to display and discuss in a very prominent manner tribal self-administration, each and every president since President Nixon has come out strongly in favor and in support of tribal self-administration. President Clinton signed in the year 2000 Executive Order 13171, which was entitled Consultation and Coordination with Native Indian Tribes. And in it, it was codified what the different responsibilities of the federal government were when they consult with federally recognized American Indian tribes. This has a very significant impact on how different branches and agencies within the federal government interact with American Indians and Alaska Natives. And it also impacts what we as researchers might do on the ground in terms of the conduct of research with this population. And I'll give you several discrete examples. First, many of you know, especially any of you who do genetic work, and increasingly large grants in general of $500,000 per year or more, there is a new data sharing requirement, a policy, an NIH policy on data sharing. You, the researcher, are expected to describe what your plan is for the sharing of an anonymized data set with the others and with the federal government. And it's a responsibility of us as grant writers, as investigators, to ensure that we describe such a plan in our grant proposals. I've always included such a plan since it's been required in my proposals, and I'll paraphrase what I generally say, and as I say, I am unable to describe for you a data sharing plan with my tribal partners. You cannot place on me a responsibility to engage in tribal consultation or coordination that is, in fact, your responsibility as a federal agency, and I will not do that on your behalf. If you wish to know what a data sharing agreement, an appropriate or negotiable data sharing agreement might be with any specific federally recognized tribe, you, the federal agency, will have to go out and negotiate that for yourselves. And then I'll agree to abide by that. That's not happened so far. I will say, though, and I should note for all of us here that the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, who has funded quite a few projects in Indian country over the years, has had conversations now in different tribal communities around the United States to discuss specifically this policy. And so it is also that acting in the spirit of tribal consultation and coordination, to my knowledge, again, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute recently brought a group of tribal leaders to the table in the early stages of the formulation of a new grant release, of a new request for applications. And so it was that tribal leaders have significantly impacted the design and creation of a new request for proposals that was released 2 years ago. Well, 3 years ago, I believe, through which I'm fortunately one of the five grantees under the project. So it's very nice to know that President Clinton and preceding presidents' visions for how tribal sovereignty may be expressed and how the federal government and all its agencies will interact with our people has been set forth in fairly discreet and specific ways. I think that's an excellent first step, and it's example. It's a very clear example, to me anyway, of the intersection of science and policy. It's true that American Indians and Alaska Natives encounter and harbor a tremendous amount of inequities along a number of different health parameters. Personally, I think that it is not helpful to try to contrast and compare in relative rank order these inequities across different populations. I personally don't wish to engage in that. I'm committed to the idea, as it has been expressed already, and I'm very pleased to hear expressed this morning, of broad-based addressing of health inequities, and particularly in focusing and in, helping to form coalitions that might work on more upstream influences and effects on those. I will point out, though, that disparities have been experienced by our people since the time of first colonization. The example of smallpox was mentioned just now. And at least in the United States and in North America, no one has more experience with, no one's suffered historically from smallpox. David Jones, writing in December of 2006 in a very, very interesting article on the persistence of health disparities in American Indians and Alaska Natives in the American Journal of Public Health, documents this 500-plus year history of disparities. And it is certainly the case that at the time of first colonization, both our people as well as non-natives literally were in shock and awe at the devastation that epidemics were raining down upon tribal people. The colonists' first town site of Plymouth was built upon the ruins of an abandoned Indian village, which had been decimated 3 years earlier by an epidemic. To give you some sense of this, let me share this with you. In 1630, 95 out of every 100 residents of the Deep South was American Indian. 95 of every 100 persons in the Deep South was American Indian in 1630. 50 years later, by 1680, due both to the effects of smallpox and the incoming arrivals of immigrants to that area, now only 5 of every 100 persons in the Deep South were American Indian. From 95% of the population to 5% of the population in a short 50 years. One can only imagine how reeling and how utterly awestruck by this tribal people in that area and other areas were by what was happening around them. Estimates of the number of our people here in the United States alone range at the low side from 5 million to the high side at 8 million at the time of first contact. At the 1900 census, between 100 and 200,000 of us were enumerated. That's a 98% population loss over 400 years. That doesn't just happen. That's why I think it's a challenge to each one of us in this room, because each one of us has both more modest and larger spheres of influence for us to carry with us, carry away from us this morning, a little greater knowledge about tribes and tribal sovereignty. The other thing that I would like to share with you today is to document or describe for you the gross disparity in funding for healthcare that exists in the country with respect to our people. The U.S. Civil Rights Commission in 2003 traveled around the country and held public hearings on the health status of our people, and had staff that did a tremendous amount of research in support of that effort and in support of the subsequent publication. And others, too, have documented that when you take the Indian Health Service budget and break it out across the population for its approximately 1.6 million users, there's between $1,650 and $2,200 per man, woman, and child spent per capita on American Indians and Alaska Natives here in this country presently. That's contrasted with $6,000 spent per year for each Medicare recipient in the country, $5,000 per year for each Medicaid recipient in the country, $4,000 per year spent on each resident of our prisons. So if it's true that in addition to upstream effects, powerful social and political forces that have shaped the existence of disparities wherever they exist in whatever population, it's also true that at least a small portion of the ability to address those disparities lies on the front line in medical care and in primary medical care. That's why it's with great hope that I saw the election results that came in last month, and even more to the point when I heard the news that Senator Daschle, the former Senate minority and majority leader from South Dakota, had been named by President-elect Obama to lead up Health and Human Services. I served on a work group at the Indian Health Service at headquarters in the mid-1990s. We were tasked with coming up with the very first needs-based budget for the Indian Health Service. In the mid-1990s, the budget at the time for the Indian Health Service was approximately $1.2 billion. And after 6 months of work, our work group, our task force, came up with our needs-based budget, which was $8 billion. Senator Daschle, 2 years later, took that figure, or slightly adjusted figure, and introduced it to the floor of the United States Senate in an effort to increase in an extraordinarily substantial way the budget of the Indian Health Service. Of course, that did not happen. But the Indian Health Service budget has grown, and today it's roughly $2.8 or $9 billion. If we were to achieve parity just in funding for health care for our people that's enjoyed by the typical American citizen, we would need an immediate infusion of $18 billion. $8 billion for facilities construction and maintenance and staffing, and $10 billion right off the top and in each year for the next 10 years just to provide health care to the population. That would bring us up to a level of parity of funding. So I urge that when we consider the addressment of equities and health equities, that we do pay attention to issues of funding, of policy, of practice. And finally, in our work with tribal people, in a particular study that I'm conducting right now with traditional healers of one of our local tribes, it would be inaccurate for me to say that I realize through this study, because I've realized before then, that what we tend to call traditional knowledge, which really more appropriately is local knowledge, or in my context, indigenous ecological knowledge, is impressive, it's vast, and it's highly underrated. So it is that part of me is just a skeptical's not the word, but to hear about evidence-based practice, for instance, just to use a very good example, evidence-based practice. What that generally means to me is a bunch of randomized clinical trials in which few, if any, of our people have been involved, and probably few, if any, of yours. And we are to just blanket accept that the results of such studies immediately cross over with the same effect on our people, in that in the meantime, the centuries of local knowledge that we've generated and that we still retain today have relatively little or no relative value. So, in our work, we often acknowledge and value and bring to the forefront local knowledge, and in fact are engaged in an effort right now to help see that more and more local knowledge influences or even serves as the foundation upon which our quote-unquote scientific investigations or studies are founded or conducted. These are some of the unique challenges that exist among American Indians and Alaska Natives and with doing work with this special population. Pila Mayapalo.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Brian Smedley with the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. I want to thank Dr. Satcher and our panelists for this wonderful set of presentations. One of the dangers of going last is that all the brilliant things have been said, so I'm going to be fairly brief. And the other danger, of course, about being last is that you're usually standing between folks and their lunch or a brilliant keynote speech. So that's another reason for me to be last. And to go quickly, I want to thank again Dr. Ruffin and his staff for this amazing gathering. I think we are, it's overwhelming. Overwhelming and remarkable to see nearly 4,000 people in a room. I don't know that we've ever achieved this feat of pulling together this number of people at the caliber of folks that we have here to address health disparities. I think when we look back in the history of our efforts to address health inequality, this is going to be one of those pivotal moments that will be in that history. Let me just talk very, very briefly about some of the challenges and some of the opportunities that I think that we have today, and I'm going to try to underscore some of the comments from our panelists. It can't be stressed enough that the current economic downturn is going to widen health inequality. I think we all know this. Given the relationship between health and wealth, health and income, health and a good job, we're going to see these health gaps widen. And my fear is that unless we are effective in communicating about how we're going to address these problems, that we are not going to take advantage of the political will to address these problems. When we look at things like the home foreclosure crisis, this is a problem that deeply affects people of color. According to one estimate, the loss of homes due to home foreclosure has been the biggest blow historically to black and Latino wealth in this country, in our nation's history. And so this has clear implications for health. So we need to be prepared to address some of these problems. There are other challenges that we face. There are persistent and widely held public myths about health inequality. I was very interested to see the slide presented earlier today, the survey, that shows that 95% of the public wants to see greater research to address health inequality. But yet I think if we ask these same folks, what do you believe are the causes of health inequality? I believe that overwhelmingly they would say, well, it's bad genes or bad behavior. And I think we all recognize the inadequacy of these myths. They do not explain health gaps, and they're not going to help us to better understand how we move forward to create solutions. So this notion of bad genes and bad behavior is so deeply intertwined with the notion, the strongly held belief in individual determinism in this country. And I think we have an opportunity to conduct research that shows the complexity of health inequality and indeed shows the complexity of inequality generally in this country. But it's this problem, this strong belief in individual determinism, that creates a problem of political will for us as we try to do this work. We've known since 1985 with the Heckler Report that health inequality is deep and persistent in America. Since then, we've had volumes and volumes of research studies. My former employer, the Institute of Medicine, has produced a number of reports documenting health inequality and steps, solutions that we can take to address these problems. But yet very little action has taken place at the federal level. Many of you know it's been since 2000 since we had major legislation to address disparities, and that legislation also created the National Center for Health Disparities. So we need to do a better job to address political will. And I think that we all have the power as a community of scholars, activists, policy analysts, and other folks to help improve that will. There are also tremendous opportunities, and I think that many of these opportunities have been highlighted earlier today, particularly with Dr. Valdez's talk. There's growing understanding of the need for interdisciplinary models to address these problems. No longer can we afford to have a narrow set of disciplines investigating health inequality. As I hope to illustrate, we're going to need strong interdisciplinary teams and interdisciplinary models to address this work. There's growing understanding of the effects of neighborhood context, particularly on the health and development of children. Some of the research, again, that was cited earlier this morning is very, very striking, showing that for some kids, by virtue of where they're born, where they grow up, their skin color, they are living in communities, in environments that have harmful effects on their physical development, their cognitive development, and, of course, these problems set a trajectory, a negative trajectory for these kids throughout their lives. I think this research is also showing the power of intergenerational problems. So those kids will have children who may suffer from health problems unless we intervene. There's also growing understanding of the power of upstream determinants, and we've seen some examples of this, particularly for people of color. We cannot ignore the issue of residential segregation. Segregation concentrates poverty for people of color. So even folk of color who have middle and upper incomes are more likely to live in high poverty communities because of residential segregation. Segregation limits socioeconomic opportunity for children. It shapes health behavior, as we've seen. It shapes diet. It shapes whether or not you have a sedentary lifestyle through factors such as physical safety, the retail food environment. We all know these problems, and we are documenting these problems with our research. And we also know that segregation exposes people of color at far higher levels to environmental degradation and environmental health risks. All of these issues shape the context for health and need to be high on our research agenda. So So we need more work in these areas, and I'm very excited about the direction that the National Center is going in and the prospects that this new intramural research center will begin to address some of these problems. But there's much more that must be done across NIH, and I think we have to address some of these issues. In 1999, almost a decade ago, the Institute of Medicine released a report called The Unequal Burden of Cancer that Dr. Satcher referenced. I was study director on that report. We had many distinguished individuals on the committee, including Dr. Moonshin. This committee made some observations about NIH that unfortunately still apply in many instances. This report observed that too many ICs don't see disparities as being high on their research agenda, as being core to the work that they do. Somehow the notion was that scientific discovery will lead to improvements for everybody. It's going to lift all boats. But as we've seen, the scientific marketplace doesn't necessarily reinforce work on health inequality. We don't see people winning Nobel Prizes for their work to study health inequality. So we need to use NIH and its levers to help stimulate that scientific marketplace. NIH's disease system and organ system organization also has been, in some respects, a hindrance to studying health inequality. Where would you study the fundamental determinants of health, such as residential segregation, neighborhood context, inequality in itself, racism? Where would you study these important issues to understand the context for health inequality for people of color? And unfortunately, again, this disease system and organ orientation has left us without a strong emphasis on prevention. Now, certainly, the CDC has an active prevention agenda, both research and application. But if we're to understand, again, the fundamental determinants of health and health inequality, prevention has to be on the agenda at NIH as well, to study the social conditions and context in which we live and how inequality and the various isms in our society get under the skin and affect health. To that end, I think it's important to state that disparities cannot be solved solely by looking through a microscope. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We need to invert the lens, turn it around, and study conditions in our society that create inequality, that perpetuate the kinds of systems that allow some to be left behind while others systematically enjoy advantages. And this is why I believe we need this strong interdisciplinary research agenda. Structural inequality, racism, discrimination are importantly part of that agenda and must be high on our list of things to accomplish and to address. We also need to connect the concerns of disparity populations. It was noted earlier today that there are many disparity populations in the United States. It's not just people of color. These include people who live in rural communities, underserved communities, LGBT people, others. Many other groups suffer from health disparities. But my concern is this, that as we connect these concerns, we have to avoid conflating the problems of many different disparity populations. We heard earlier today about the importance of studying poverty, and we heard from several distinguished individuals about the growing understanding of inequality and poverty on health. But let's not conflate the issues of poverty for people of color and low-income white populations. They're vastly different experiences for poor people of color who are far more likely to be in segregated communities facing a whole host of health risks, whereas low-income whites are more likely to be dispersed throughout communities with different socioeconomic levels. Now, this isn't to diminish the concerns of many low-income white populations, particularly those in Appalachia, other communities with concentrated poverty. But let's not conflate the problems of poor people of color and poor whites. To that end, we need to better understand the lived experience of race. Okay, as we've pointed out here, race is a social construct. It has no biological meaning, but it has social and political meaning. And in the United States, race is important because of the lived experience of race, the experience of people of color living in this country with its history of vast inequality and evidence of contemporary inequality and discrimination. Consider the health consequences of not being able to find a job, an important study recently using paired testers, individuals who are matched in a range of characteristics, one African-American, one white, sent out into the community to find jobs. They found that even white job seekers with a criminal record had a better likelihood of getting a callback for a job interview than African-Americans with no criminal record. Think that has no health consequences? Of course it does. We also need to consider that disparity populations tend to be people who have been displaced from their land. These are people who have been removed from their ancestral lands. And this, to me, is one of the most striking reasons why we need to have interdisciplinary research. We need to have historians at the table to help us understand this context and understand how it is that this experience of inequality and displacement, again, gets under the skin. Finally, I want to just comment on our language and process. We've talked a lot about disparities, cultural competency, inequality. In some cases, these words don't mean much outside of this room. We need to be aware of that. We need to be talking in a more consistent language that resonates with our mothers, our grandmothers, people in our communities. And we also ought to take note of our process. And I don't mean this as a criticism, but I want to note as a process point that I see no women on our panel here this morning. So I think it's important. I think it's important as we spend these next 3 days together to go about our work and, as Dr. Angelou challenged us, compose a new song and think about ways that we can be more integrated and working together strategically to advance this agenda. Thank you.
Wow, what an outstanding panel. Let's give them another hand, really. Well, I think it's very clear at that intersection between science and practice and policy, there are some major challenges that we face and some major opportunities. So I look forward to the rest of this very special conference, and right now I look forward to lunch, and I'm sure you do too. Thank you.